sleeping outside. Can't wait to be super wet. Can't wait to be super wet while I'm there.
At least it won't be snowing. Could always be worse.
I'd rather have snow, personally.
That's true. You always can get warmer, but you can't get drier.
Exactly. All right. So, put a line in your notebooks. Exams 1, 2, and 3 are in the books. Now we're going on to our fourth exam. Just a reminder from the two or three of you that did not have me before, finals are not cumulative. All it's going to be is just the fourth exam. The only difference is that it will count 2.5 times more than exams 1, 2, and 3. And I do that because usually students do best on the final exam. Although for most of you, I don't think there's going to be any issues with that because you're all been doing fine. But the final will take place on May the 9th. It will be in Engage, so you don't have to be here. But that's the last day of the semester. What?
Nothing.
Oh. Oh, all right. Yes.
Is it going to be the cumulative of all three previous exams, or just going to be like what we covered up to four?
Do you want it to be cumulative?
No, just curious.
So why don't we just have it be the fourth exam? Okay. The other grade that is, so the final is 35%. The other grade that will make up the rest of the 100% of your final average is your paper. Paper is due April 26th. Now I think two of you have gotten your papers in, so you don't have to worry about it. But the rest of you, remember, it's 20% of your grade. Before you drop it in the Dropbox, make sure you check out proflamanic.com. Make sure you understand how I'm going to grade it. I grade it a little differently than most professors. This assignment is basically about following directions. And for every direction you do not follow, you lose points. So, good grades come from those who follow the directions. Bad grades arise from those who don't. So, if you have any questions, particularly those of you who've never had me before, ask. Those of you who had me before, you know, I'm going to lay it all out. I'll explain what you did right, what you did wrong, and you'll know exactly where you stand. All right. So, we've dealt with how the war started, why the war started, and we've dealt with 2.5 years of conflict. And sadly, on the Western Front, nothing changed. And on the Eastern Front, Russia is slowly starting to deteriorate. But the one issue that would transform the justification, the rationale, and the motivation to bring this war to an conclusion was submarine warfare. Now, FYI, in the First World War, England, France, the United States, Italy, they all had submarines. But the most effective users of those platforms as tools of war were the Germans. In total, they sunk 2,550 vessels, big and small. So it would be this platform that would, like I said, spark outrage. Now, here's the thing. Germany didn't go into the war intending to use submarine warfare. In fact, they were forced to unleash what they called the Unterseebooten. Unter, under, sea, Booten. This is where the name U-boats come from. They would use subs to balance the scales of the war. Because what was England doing?
Blockading.
They were blockading them. They essentially were strangling the German economy into submission. So U-boats were used to try to break holes in the blockade as well as deny foodstuffs from reaching England. Because England is an island. And in order for England to get food, it relied upon imports as well. So in the German minds, and fair-minded people, I think, would agree, to a degree, this was kind of tit for tat. Ironically, submarines were invented by the British, but they were ignored completely by the Admiralty. The reason being was, in the British noble mindset, sneaking upon your prey and unleashing death from the deeps was dishonorable. The only way to fight honorably is face to face, mano a mano. That's the only way to get glory. But like I said, ultimately it was the Germans that would make the leap.
So with the British officer corps, they were more like gentlemanly, I guess, is what you're trying to say.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But of course, gentlemanly to their standards.
So, debatable.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. So, ultimately, it would be the Germans, who we said, that would view the lethality and the potential of submarines. And as early as 1907, as Tirpitz was modernizing and rapidly trying to expand the German Navy, he made sure there were significant line items for U-boats. And once they were constructed, they were deployed. And they began going out globally. But once the war started, the Germans also started funding innovations, improvements upon the platform. So resources were free to improve the engines, to expand the capabilities of the torpedoes. They innovated the periscope and the design, which would basically allow them to look out from under the sea. Talk about terrifying, though. They didn't have sonar back then. So you go in a steel tube underwater and you just drive and you hope you don't run into anything. Yeah, scary. Scary, scary. And by the way, even though when the war started, England and France had more subs, by the end of the war, Germany was producing submarines at the same clip that England was trying to produce replacement ships. Almost from the announcement of the blockade, Germany, like it did with the blimps, like it did with chemical warfare, would attempt to issue psychological blows to break the will of the civilian populations. The first submarine attack came on September 26, 1914. When German U-boat U-9, captained by Otto Wenigin, shocked the world when, in one battle, managed to sink three British cruisers in a span of 90 minutes. Because of it located out in the North Sea, all 1,600 lives on board were lost. Now, FYI, if you recall when I talked about Jellicoe and his hesitancy to send the Navy in closer, this is the reason why, because of this event. You never knew what was lurking underneath the waters. So are you going to risk treasure and blood to be attacked from a direction you can't see it coming? Now, ultimately, submarines would play a role not anticipated by even the most leading naval experts. It would be used as a method to counter British tactics. And I want to emphasize that. Germany didn't go out and intend to use them. Their use was a reaction. Tit for tat. because it all starts with the Brits. Under international law, blockades can only be legal if you stop belligerent vessels. So if you're a British ship, you can stop a German ship. But under international law, you're not supposed to stop neutral ships going to neutral ports. But England didn't care. They were stopping everything. So the Germans basically decide, well, two can play at that game. If you can stop everything, we can sink everything. But of course, the moments the Germans use them, then suddenly you have a whole new situation that's challenging to international law. So if you're going to use a ship in a blockade, you can either turn back the ships, or you can stop the ships and take the cargo. But you don't destroy the ship, you don't destroy the crew. But with a submarine blockade, the only way it works is if you sink the ships. So, subs on their face are lethal. Because after all, who in their right mind would want to be in a thin steel tube and have your submarine come to the surface and say, no, no, no. You don't have to have big guns. Just have a couple of deck guns. Launch a couple of well-placed rounds, and that steel tube is going down. So, a sub-base blockade is going to, by default, result in death. So, the Germans basically, again, like I said, sat back and said, tit for tat. The Brits are violating the law, so can we. Because at the end of the day, we're worried about our survival. On February 4th, 1915, Germany would issue a declaration in which it laid out that legally, officially, they were going to counter the British blockade of the North Sea with a submarine blockade of the British Isles. And it was straightforward, and I quote, "All of the waters surrounding Great Britain and Ireland, including the whole of the English Channel, are hereby declared a war zone. Every enemy merchant ship found within this war zone will be destroyed, without it always being possible to avoid danger to the crews and passengers. It is impossible to avoid attacks being made on neutral vessels in mistake for those of the enemy. We're going to shoot first, sink first, and we're not even going to bother asking questions. And just like England was not allowing neutral ships to pass through their blockade, if a neutral ship is in British waters, it's going to be sunk. Because mistakes happen." Questions? Now, ironically, most of the world got it. And most of the neutral nations, while their feathers were rankled, they kind of sat back and said, well, it is what it is. The only exception to this, ironically, coincidentally, are these United States of America. Because the nation that would make the most noise protesting the use of blockades above sea and below was America. Questions? All right, let's do a quick history lesson. Oh, wait, this is all history. Now, you guys, unfortunately for you, are at a point when there are many forces in this country internally that are trying to destroy it from within. Because there are potentially as many people born and raised here that hate this country as love it. But the reason why we are this way is because pretty much with the fall of the Soviet Empire, we won and we became soft and complacent. And out of complacency, that allows people to be born and spoiled, have no real struggles, and as a result, can sit back and whine and piss and moan about how hard their lives are, even though they still have food, they still have roof over their head, they have clothes on their back. Hell, y'all have the damn idiot boxes. But it wasn't the same in 1914. America was not America then. America in 1914 was not the global superpower. It wasn't even really considered a great power. It was merely a regional power that dominated the Western Hemisphere. And ironically, the overwhelming majority of Americans believed in America first. They had no interest in being the world police. They had no interest in becoming entangled in American affairs, because the Americans in 1914 were still living according to the lessons given to them by none other than the father of our country, George Washington. When in his farewell address to the nation, he basically said, it's okay to be friends with every nation in the world, and do business with them, but avoid foreign entanglements. Ironically, when World War I erupted, the president of these United States at the time, Democrat Woodrow Wilson, would formally proclaim neutrality. And he made appeals to the nation in the early days of the war that we as citizens should, and I quote, remain impartial in thought as well as act. In other words, it's not our problem. And while they didn't have opinion polls like they do today, historians have dug into it, and to the best evidence they could find, it seems that the overwhelming majority of Americans believed there was no reason to get involved in this. Not our problem. America was a complicated country in 1914. Because in 1914, thanks to the waves of legal immigrants who came across the Atlantic Ocean and were processed through Ellis Island, about 30% of the country were actually not born in America. They were foreign-born. Unlike today, where probably about 30% of the people living in the country are illegal immigrants. But these people, similar to the illegal immigrants, were biased towards their homelands. So, take the 30%, pretty much divide them in half. Half of them were going pro-Entente, and half of them were going Central Powers. Which, for the President of the United States, makes things complicated, because he's not a king. In order to win elections, he got to get votes. Now, while the nation might have been divided on who was to blame and who we should root for, the president was, without question, sympathetic to the Allies. Which is interesting, again, when you consider the complexity of American history. The first bad guy was the mother country. And the United States fought two wars with England. And we had many instances where the United States was on the brink of going to a third war. Border disputes, interference in commerce. I mean, life wasn't peachy keen. But the Brits, since the 1880s, once Germany was unified, started realizing, like they kind of became friends with Japan, that maybe they should warm up relations with the United States. Because they didn't want to have to worry about going to war with the United States over Canada, say, when they're trying to control China. So, since the 1880s, England had been working to maintain friendship, if you will, with the United States. So, by the time Woodrow Wilson came in, you got about 30 years of diplomacy of the two nations, maybe not necessarily working always hand in hand, but definitely along similar lines. Oh, Boston, I want to go to Falmouth. I'll wait. All right. Plus, if you came down to it, England also had another advantage. Same language, same basic culture. They had been engaged in trade, close finance relations.
Religion.
Yeah. WASP, White Anglo-Saxon Protestantism. Yeah. But interestingly enough, the United States also historically was linked with France. I mean, after all, if it wasn't for the French, and it pains me to admit this, we never would have won our independence. Louis XVI gave us big loans that we were able to use to buy mercenaries and buy weapons and foodstuffs. Plus, some French officers, including Lafayette, came and worked with Washington to command and train our armies. Plus, they gave us the entire French Navy to use. So we would not have won our independence without the friendship of the French. Plus, Belgium, a neutral nation like the United States, was Germany's first victim. So when you put all this together, the president was kind of like, well, the two sides aren't equal. And because of the language, the Allies, the Entente, had a huge advantage in being able to produce propaganda that could play on the heartstrings of Americans. Love some of these images. Love some of these images. Look, Britishers, this is an appeal to American people, American citizens of British descent. You know, look, come join your brothers. We need you. Oh, look at this. Look at the evil Huns causing terror and abusing the poor women and children. Are you gonna fight now or wait for this to come to your country? Or, I love this one, look at the Hun. Oh, he's looked like King Kong holding the damsel in distress. And just on and on and on. The British printers could make these images in English, and they understood American advertising. So these images appeared in magazines, newspapers, posters. They were all around for the people to see. So, the Allies are fighting to save decency, civilization itself, from the vile, evil Hun. Where the Germans are content on conquering and subjugating the world. Of course, neither are true. But propaganda doesn't aim to tell the truth. The most significant aspect was the disruption of commerce. Again, Washington said, Be friendly to all, but avoid foreign entanglements. Being friendly means you're going to do business with anybody. Doesn't matter who they are, what their cause is. Their money is as green as the next guy. But when this war started, all of the mechanisms, the flow of wealth was completely disrupted. And interestingly enough, the United States was on the brink of a depression. Our economy almost completely imploded because we were dependent upon imports from Europe, as well as loans from Europe. Here is the stock market. Everything's doing okay, and then suddenly you have the assassination of Franz Joseph, and look what happens, boop. It plummeted. And then as the war continues, then it plummets again. A 33% drop in the stock market. Millions of dollars gone. And U.S. trade turned to pennies. Prior to World War I, the United States on average was doing about $170 million in 1914 money trade with the Central Powers. But because of the blockade, fell to virtually nothing. FYI, that's billions of dollars today. So we lost the ability to buy and sell things from essentially Sweden, Finland, Germany, the Netherlands, Denmark, Russia, because it was all blocked up because of the blockade. Awful collapse. But then notice what happens. By 1915, the market is higher than it was prior to the war. Why is that? Well, this one. As the war continued, and the Allies had to send their boys to fight in the Western Front or in Gallipoli or other places on Earth, they couldn't work in the factories. They couldn't work in the fields. So where are you going to get the supplies and food so their soldiers can fight? Well, you got to look for new sources. The United States, which prior to the war had a completely skewed trading system in which we were importing way more than we were exporting, suddenly things shifted. And by the end of 1915, the United States had become, for all sakes and purposes, the principal supplier of vital commodities to the Allies. Because while you couldn't get a ship to Germany, you could get a ship to England or Ireland or France. And we're talking off the scale. So, 1900. Yeah, that's about how much cotton we're producing. By 1915, 2.5 times more. Tobacco doubles. Wheat and wheat flour goes from a little under $1 million 1914 money all the way up to $450 million. Animal fats, oils, never exported it, suddenly we start exporting it. Meat, automobiles, engine parts, auto parts, petroleum, iron, steel, machinery, copper. Things that we had never made or shipped, suddenly we're producing in mass. And at the register, cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. So, while at the start of the war, most of the Americans were saying, by 1915, 1916, well, even though we're still going to technically be neutral, a lot of the businessmen and farmers, bankers, munition factory owners are saying, keep selling, boys. Because the gains more than offset the losses. And trade with the Allies, which in 1914 was about $1,825 million, 1914 money, by 1916, that skyrocketed to $3.2 billion. And this would create a boom in our economy that would roar all the way into 1919. Now, here's the amazing thing about Americans. For the most part, most Americans don't really get caught up in ideology. But most Americans pretty much all agree in the importance of the color green. So, even though the Americans valued neutrality, they didn't think trade violated those principles. Because, going back to Washington's message, do business with anybody. So if you can't do business with the Germans, do business with the English. It's not saying we like the English more. We just like the English money because we can get it. But under international law, we have a situation here. Because while neutral nations could conduct trade with belligerent nations, there were strict limitations on what could be sold. Contraband, items that could be used for war, were off the table. So, you were not supposed to be sending bullets and guns and plane engines and things like that. We can send food, we can send medicine, we could send clothes, but no bombs and bullets. But guess what we'd be sending?
Oh yeah, bombs, guns, bullets, all that.
Why?
Well, we were profiting off of it, and the British needed some of the French, so why wouldn't we? Money. Money.
This is why. Americans had no issue whatsoever with selling anything, regardless of what international law said, because for the Americans, it was about the bottom line. Plus, by selling to the English and the French, what are they not trying to violate? Which was set up by the British. Above sea, out in the open for all to see. Blockades. Sorry, I thought that was the next click. I guess not. We'll go to here. There we go. So the Americans were willing to sell and kind of ignore the Germans because the Germans were being blockaded by what under international law is a legal blockade. The ships were there, they were active, the blockade was effective. But the naval blockade by the German undersea boats, that was not open. That was not active. That was not effective. So the Americans basically began saying that, look, we're going to trade with whoever we want. We think that we're going to not violate the British blockade because that's okay. The German blockade, the Germans can go pound sand, and no one's going to mess with us. Those are our issues because at the end of the day, the Americans are motivated to make money. And again, not meaning to be redundant. If need be, you could ship your goods to an English colony or a French colony. You don't even have to take them into the German war zone. You can unload your cargo and let the English or the French ships take it in. And then, that's called a loophole, and we're not violating anyone's blockade. Questions? All's fair, right? In love and war.
only send it to the home mind.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, fortunately or unfortunately, depending upon your political persuasion, the problem that we had was the man who occupied 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was the prototypical white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, progressive, who believed, from a moral perspective, he always had the highest ground. That his perspectives were the only perspectives. And in terms of his declaration of neutrality, that declaration, which was formal, gave the United States the absolute protection of international law to engage in whatever commerce the United States deemed fit. So, he expected the nations killing one another in the war to always respect the rights of neutral nations, no matter what the civil situation is. So what that the Europeans are involved in a struggle for survival? So what that, you know, modern methods of technology make old-fashioned international law obsolete? You know, never mind that. Again, imagine one guy running across no man's land, managing to make it through the barbed wire and all the machine guns, ending up in another trench and using your shovel or the butt of your rifle to basically bludgeon the other guy's skull in. That's what the men of Europe were doing. Do you think they cared about the American president saying, "Stop"? Well, as a result, even though the United States was doing business, trying to do business with anybody and everyone, it would only be a matter of time before soon he was engaged in clashes of a political and ideological nature with both sides. Ironically, in terms of headaches, the British were the worst. Almost out of the gates, the goodwill that had been slowly breaking out and permeating between the United States and England was on the verge of complete breakdown because of things that the Brits did. The first thing was at the start of the war when they changed the definition of contraband. Under international law, as we said, contraband was only those items that could be used in war. Guns, bullets, helmets, things like that. Under international law, you can sell those goods to neutrals, but you can't sell them to belligerents on either side. But what the Brits did, being clever, they included foodstuffs. Because food items are going to be put in containers and shipped to the front lines and end up in men's bellies. And the more food that the soldiers had, the harder they're going to fight. Also, other things that give indirect aid. Bandages, drinks, alcohol, like medicinal alcohol, blankets, clothing. All of those things can be used on the front. So, England declared, we catch one of your ships, any ship coming into the waters, and these ships are headed to England, not Germany, or any of the Central Powers. We're going to seize the cargo. Problem number two. The Brits, because they controlled the high seas, began taking what we could consider to be liberties with the traditional rights of a belligerent to stop and search a neutral ship suspected to go towards the other belligerent port. Under international law, a nation engaged in a war has the right to stop and search even neutral ships. It could then be seized if the content of cargo exceeds the means of confiscation. So if you get an ocean-going vessel and the whole cargo hull is filled with tons and tons and tons of stuff, under international law, you could seize the ship. You could tow it back to your port, and the owner could basically sue in a special admiralty court called a prize court and get it released if the court determines those goods were not in fact contraband. Well, here's the thing. If you go into a wooden sailing boat, you can kind of go down below, you can kind of get a bird's eye view of the entire hull, whereas a modern ship has multiple cargo ports, all that can be locked and secured behind steel doors. The Brits basically stopped the practice of stopping and searching, and instead, more often than not, stopped and seized. So even ships that had nothing on it that was going to the other belligerent could be taken. And the owner of the ship would have to hire lawyers and the headache and the expense. Well, here's the thing. If you have a cargo full of Legos, those Legos can sit on board the ship for years and years and years. What happens if you have a cargo hold full of apples or pumpkins, or potatoes?
It will rot.
So this delay essentially was destroying the private property of these businesses. And finally, in using their blockade, they're not only blocking the German ports, but as I said, they're blocking access to Belgium, which is occupied, the Netherlands, which is neutral, Denmark, which is neutral, Sweden, which is neutral, Finland. They're denying the United States the ability to trade with other neutral nations. And England said, yeah, too bad. Oh, hold on. Oh, I can't forget this also. The Brits would also begin dropping sea mines. Sea mines don't fit into the active description of effective and actual. So even if for some reason you manage to run the blockade, if you pull your ship into a neutral port, it could be exploded. Well, as incident after incident where American vessels were stopped, searched, and seized began to expand in incident, Wilson, angered, began formally protesting by sending to London formal diplomatic notes complaining that all of these actions were direct violations of international law. I love this cartoon so much. When the Brits received the American complaints, oh, look at these sarcastic, oh no, we're hurting the feelings of America, oh no. They viewed the United States as a joke. It wasn't a global power. Oh no, Woodrow Wilson is mad. Woodrow Wilson is angry and offended. England replied, hello, we're in a war for survival, and I don't care about any rules. Because at the end of the day, it's going to be England first. So all of the other considerations of international law, they're obsolete. And then, to stick it in the eye of Wilson, London also drew up a list of 85 American businessmen and U.S. firms suspected of giving aid to Germany and made it illegal for British subjects to do business with them. Have you heard of Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller? Those huge American monopolies were named. So England was basically going to essentially use the boycotts to do to the American economy what the blockade was doing to the Germans. Needless to say, Wilson was outraged. But here's the thing. He never once considered going to war against England over the violations. He knew if the United States challenged the British position, American ships and lives would be lost. Because in 1914, the American Navy, I think, ranked 13th in the world. So when his advisor said, Mr. President, you just got mocked. You got to do something about it. According to quotes that come from inside his cabinet meetings, Wilson declared at one point, England is fighting our fight. And when cabinet members heard that, they began to protest. Wilson replied, and I quote, gentlemen, the Allies are standing with their backs to the wall fighting wild beasts. If you're going to protest, you protest. You just don't sit there and say, stop. Well, at the end of the day, you don't care about the consequences. Questions? Well, here's the funny thing. For the first 2 years of the war, most of the United States protests were aimed at England. Because England was more frequently than the Germans violating international law. Hundreds of American ships were stopped. Dozens were seized. Almost on a daily basis. But the biggest difference between what the English were doing, oh yeah, your wheat, your potatoes are going to rot. The biggest difference between what the Brits were doing and what the Germans were doing was that if a German violated international law, the American ship, its cargo, and its crew are going to go to Davy Jones's locker. So, in terms of the ethics and morality of Woodrow Wilson, the thing about green is that if you lose your green, you don't end up dead. You always can go back and make more green. Whereas y'all only have one life. Questions? Now, unfortunately, as we saw the stock market, as 1914 gave way to 1915, and 1915 begins giving way to 1916, this was resulting in more and more entanglement. There were more American ships steaming towards the belligerent countries, which created more opportunities to have U.S. ships targeted. Particularly when U.S. ships tried piercing the German blockade. U-boat commanders did not do the stop and search. They put their periscope up, they saw a ship, and went poosh! And that they had no interest in prize taking. They had no interest in stopping and searching vessels. Because again, submarines are tiny steel cylinders that if you pull up to what you think is a passenger ship or a cargo ship, and suddenly the crew, as you're sailing close, pulls off the tarp and they have actual deck guns, they're going to sink you. So rather than risking German lives or German vessels, the Germans shot first, ask questions never. So the hit and run, soon in the eyes of the Americans, started being much worse than the more frequent stopping and seizing by the Brits. Now, I also have to state for the record that the Germans also did give fair warning. As I read that declaration, which was announced on February 4th, the Germans announced to the world that any ship coming into these waters essentially is fair game. They announced that all enemy ships would be destroyed on sight. Military, merchant, passenger. And they also warned, reality speaking, you got your Unterseeboat captain looking through a periscope and he sees the ship. Do you think they're going to come up close to try to figure out, oh, what color is the flag? Plus, how easy is it for the British to pull down the British flag and fly an American flag? So the Germans basically told the neutral nations, look, we can't guarantee your ship's safety, so don't come. This was followed up 2 weeks later on February 19th when the Germans made an offer to modify the threat of its blockade. They promised to stop submarine warfare if the Allies basically allowed foodstuffs to come through the blockade. In other words, if England followed international law, so would we. But guess what the Brits said? The Brits refused to compromise. They weren't going to modify their definitions. They weren't going to break the blockade. So as a result, more and more Allied vessels began being sunk. And it was in this ramping up, February, March, going into April 1915, when a huge event occurred. Kaiser's government decided to appeal directly to the American people. Because the American population at the time had a very large voting bloc made up of German Americans. Heck, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio. Most of those cities were filled with nothing but Germans. Pennsylvania. So, it was actually printed in the newspapers. And copies of the article that was circulated to all the major newspapers in the United States were printed both in English and in German. And it read as follows. Travelers intending to embark on the Atlantic voyage are reminded that a state of war exists between Germany and her allies and Great Britain and her allies. That the zone of war includes the waters adjacent to the British Isles. That in accordance with the formal notice given by the Imperial German government, vessels flying the flags of Great Britain or any of her allies are liable to destruction in those waters. And that travelers sailing in the war zone on ships of Great Britain or her allies do so at their own risk. Americans, don't be dumb. Don't be dumb. That's what I tell my kids all the time. That's my fatherly advice to them. I said, just don't be dumb. Strikingly, the U.S. Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, took this German threat seriously. And he urged Wilson, don't run the risk. Don't allow American lives to be put in jeopardy. Use your powers as president and forbid U.S. citizens from sailing to Europe. Wilson's response? No. You know why? Americans have right to travel. And no one has a right to interfere with those God-given rights. By the way, that's the reason why Americans are traveling to the Ukraine still. They're traveling to Russia. They're traveling to Israel. I don't know if many of them are going into the Gaza Strip, but Americans till this day still travel frequently to war zones. They're warned, but go at your own risk. So now imagine for more of this. Imagine there being a very large ship, passenger ship, with a little more than 100 of Americans on board, sailing under the British flag, heading towards England. Well, on May 7th, 1915, at 2 p.m., German submarine U-20 came across the Lusitania as it was making its way from the United States to Liverpool. It departed from the United States on May 1st, 1915. Made the 6-day cruise across the Atlantic, and as it was skirting the coast of Ireland, U-20, Captain Walther Schwager sees the Lusitania in his periscope and gave the order to fire one torpedo. The torpedo struck and there was an explosion. But seconds later, a much larger explosion erupted from within the boat. And it was the second explosion that caused the boat to almost break in half and sink in 18 minutes. Guess what the first explosion triggered that was sitting in the hull of the Lusitania?
I imagine ammunition wasn't there, bombs.
173 tons of rifle cartridges. So, why on God's earth would you smuggle live ammunition on a passenger ship? According to Zweiger's accounts, his intent was to shoot one torpedo, cause damage to it, and then he would sail off and allow the people to come get out on their lifeboats and basically row to shore. But because of the ammunition, because of the second explosion, 1,198 passengers launched, including 120 Americans. Now, incidentally, only 6 of the 48 lifeboats would be launched, and most of the people on those lifeboats either drowned in the rough seas as they overturned. And once you're in the cold North Atlantic waters, guess what happens to your body? In minutes.
Hypothermia and you die.
Yep.
And the North Sea is the most treacherous sea on the planet, so good luck.
Yep.
You'll die very, very quickly.
I don't even think they had a chance to become shark bait.
Nope, you die almost instantly.
Now here's the thing. The fact that there was ammunition on board was kept classified until the 1960s. But instead, the sinking of this passenger vessel was sensationalized in all of the newspapers around the world. The lives were ignored because of the shock value of the situation. What?
People thought that the paper would always tell the truth back in the day. Like, oh, why is the media so dishonest now? No, my friend, it's always been dishonest.
It's always been. The only difference is now, I think, I hope most of people realize it. I said most, not all, most.
You got a problem if you don't notice it.
Yeah. Well, the consequence of this image of innocent lives being lost, became political. Americans began changing their tune from staying out of it to, maybe we want to get some revenge. But Wilson had issues. We'll talk about them in a minute. Actually, we might not get to them today. But following diplomatic procedure and protocol, just as he did with England, he would send off 3 diplomatic notes. Apparently, one of them was so strongly worded that it was, for all sakes and purposes, a threat of war. Well, under the way it works, the president writes it and then he gives it to the Secretary of State, and the State Department is in charge of diplomacy. So the president signs it, then the Secretary of State signs it, and then it becomes formalized and it's sent off. Well, when Bryan read that third note that was on the brink of declaring war, he was so disgusted he resigned. Because his issue was, Wilson was a freaking hypocrite. England had been doing this to a greater level, stopping more ships, stopping more vessels, seizing more cargo, harassing American businessmen. Germany warned Americans that they were taking their lives in their own hands, and you, Mr. President, had a chance to stop it and you chose not to. You can't turn around and blame Germany. So being a man of principle, he resigned. But, interestingly enough, the notes would eventually impact Germany. Taking the president's threat seriously, because the last thing Germany wanted was another nation coming into the war, Germany would respond by issuing a declaration on September 9th, that in which it declared the U-boats going forward would only attack ships that definitively were British. So, meaning, they not only would look for the flag, but they would sail around the back and they would acknowledge the identification markers that are painted on the ship's backside. Oh, yeah. Neutral ships, however, would be stopped. So the sub would come to the surface and they would engage in search and seizure. So neutral ships would be treated under prize laws. So basically, we're going to do to you what England's doing. And no attacks under any circumstances would be allowed on passenger ships. But guess what the Brits started doing? Lowering the British flag, replacing it with American, or even worse, taking some paint and changing the identification markers. Last point of the day. Needless to say, the Germans soon became impatient and the sinking of ships continued. Reaching a climax of sorts. Fast forward to March 21st, 1960. A French ship, the Sussex, would be targeted by SMUB-29. This ship was a French ship that had served as a cross-channel steamer. So it only went from France to England and back. And it constantly brought back and forth passengers and whatever cargo they could fit on the ship. The commander of SMUB-29, Herbert Pushkin, thought the Sussex was a minesweeper. So he couldn't tell that it was a civilian ship. He thought it was a military vessel. So, following orders, he fired off a torpedo. And it blew the bow off the ship. But amazingly, because of the different compartments, it didn't sink. It would actually be towed back to shore. It would be repaired, it would be put back to sea in 1919, but it would be scrapped in 1923. Well, here's the thing. It didn't sink, but the explosion did cause 50 deaths and 80 casualties. 80 people were hurt. Among those hurt were 25 Americans. These Americans were in the war zone, literally. Well, needless to say, this would give Woody a chance to preach. In response to the strike on the Sussex, in an address to Congress, he would directly condemn the German actions. And at one point during the middle of his speech, he said the following, and I quote, "Unless the Imperial German government should now immediately declare and effect an abandonment of its present method of warfare against passenger and freight carrying vessels, this government can have no choice but to sever diplomatic relations with the government of the German Empire altogether." First step to going to war, my friends. You break diplomatic relations. Well, the Germans, alarmed, did something rather extraordinary. They promised to abandon the U-boat campaign around Great Britain, and they promised to recall their subs that had been prowling in the Mediterranean. Instead, passenger ships would be left unmolested. Merchant ships, if it was flying under any nation's flag, would be searched, and it would only be sunk if military contraband was discovered. But they would only do so if the United States holds England accountable for its violations of international law. So Germany said, "We'll do this if England does that." Wilson ignored the "that," and he would hold Germany to the promise that they said, no more search or sinking passenger ships, and merchant ships would be stopped and only sunk if contraband was on board. It was only a matter of time. But Wilson's playing politics. Questions? All right, we'll come back on Thursday. We got more to say about what Merkel was doing. And, yeah, we're going to end up with the United States joining the war. And that probably will take the bulk of the day. And then after that, we got to talk about a little revolution that erupted in Russia as a consequence of the war as well. Papers, 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 April 26th. And hopefully I'll get your papers, your exams graded by Wednesday. So if not Wednesday, by Friday. All right?
I think I got to take the quiz.